This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. That is a Buddhist monk blowing into this gigantic seashell.
This is an instrument for purify the ground and celebrate God's or nature's universe.
He was blowing his seashell in Yoyogi Park in the middle of Tokyo. Studio 360 was just there, and we were running all around for weeks, talking to artists, writers, cutting-edge designers, and eating weird stuff while people chain-smoked around us. We'll have a lot more to tell you about our trip on next week's show, but one of my first stops was to visit an old friend. Pico Iyer is a travel writer, maybe the foremost travel writer in the world right now, as well as a novelist. Pico lives near the town of Nara, an ancient place. It was the capital of Japan back in the 8th century. He took me to this beautiful park filled with 1,200 insanely tame deer. Mating deer. They roam free.
And they pretty much rule the place. They're associated with a shrine here, and they're regarded as sacred messengers, emissaries from the gods, actual living treasures. So if you and or I were to hit a deer inadvertently as we walked away from here, we'd be liable to imprisonment, actually. They're the most protected beings in Nara.
I was careful not to hit a deer. Pico Iyer has been in Japan for most of the last two decades. He came, like a lot of Westerners, to study Buddhism. He was going to live in a monastery for a year.
And of course, my year lasted a week, because as soon as I got here, I found that a week or a year in a monastery was not sitting contemplating the full moon and writing depthless haiku and all the aesthetic beauties that I'd imagined in Santa Barbara. It was scrubbing the floors and raking the leaves and incredibly hard work of the kind that I'd already done much too much of in English boarding school. And also I found, as soon as I arrived in the Zen temple in Japan, it was filled with people from Santa Cruz, Boston, and Berkeley. So I told myself, and I think there's some truth to it, that I could learn more about that Buddhism just by walking down the streets and going into the convenience stores and department stores and McDonald's and seeing not really so much the forms that had so bewitched me in poems and woodcuts, but the values that underlie the forms. For example, if you're in a McDonald's, you'll notice how a mother almost silently will impart to her five-year-old son how to give his food to his little sister or how to think about the harmony of the whole much more than getting the French fries that he wants. And at every level, you're seeing this invisible training in attentiveness, which I think is really what makes the whole society function still.
But instead of simply going back to Santa Barbara after a week, you have remained here most of your time. Why are you here?
It's a wonderful place to write. Extremely quiet. Everything works. It's a wonderful mix, I find, of energy and tranquility. There's always a sense everyone around me in the streets is going somewhere, doing something. It's very, very directed, and yet they're infallibly silent while they're doing it.
So Japan is kind of a McDowell colony for you permanently. It's a place where you can work.
Exactly so. And the thing that's really preserved my sanity here is I've never had to be a grown-up here. I've never done one day of work within Japanese society. Happily, I'm just able to be a foreigner with diplomatic immunity, as it were, walking through the surfaces of this endlessly fascinating and changing society, looking through the windows, but never actually having to be in the thick of the conversation, which is not what everybody would choose. But the great foreign expat in Japan, Donald Ritchie, an American writer who's been here since 1946, always says, coming to Japan, he gave up a sense of belonging for a sense of freedom. And so I suppose that's the trade I've made. I've never really wanted to be a part of a community, so this is ideal because I'm always apart from it.
What do you find to be the uniquely Japanese aspects of Japan?
Silence, attention, selflessness. And it took me a long time after I got to Japan to learn to stop my mouth, to attend to what was going on around me, to notice what kind of tea the woman on the other side of the table was drinking. All those quiet things that seem kind of obsolete or old-fashioned in 21st century Japan, but I think really make up the fabric and the backbone of the country and what keeps it so distinctive. I mean, as you said, I've been here 20 years now, and it feels ever more like another planet to me. And in a completely confounding way. I mean, it's almost like a 2,000-year-old person wearing a microskirt and artificial tan and carrying a surfboard. And I think when we respond to Japanese artists, whether it's Haruki Murakami, the writer, or Issey Miyake, or even Nobu, the chef, what all of them are doing is in some ways packaging something very old in a very sleek, cool, new form.
How much Japanese do you speak now?
Very, very little. And I can come up with all forms of ways of justifying it to myself. But really, I gave up before I began.
But and really, how much can you speak? I mean, can you say, what? Can you say, where's the train station?
Yes, I can do that. Enough to get around, but not to have a conversation, which suits the Japanese perfectly, because they're very happy not to have a conversation with me. And I think my part in the formalized pageantry of Japanese society is to be the scruffy beast in the margins who never begins to intrude on the society. Even though I've lived here 20 years, it used to be that every time I flew into Osaka Airport, 3-4 times a year, they would always strip search me at the airport. As soon as they saw me, the panic signals
even
would go off.
Even before they thought you were a terrorist? This is long before 9/11?
Long before 9/11, but even then, partly because of their distance from the world, they thought either I was an illegal immigrant from Iran, which I could look like with my Indian complexion, or I was Saddam Hussein's brother, or most of all, just that I was a wild card. I didn't fit into the equation of Japanese society. And the way the society functions here is really, I think, like an orchestra. Everyone is playing from the same score. Each has his or her own instrument, but the intent always is larger harmony. And in an orchestra, let's say you've got the New York Symphony playing Beethoven, if suddenly someone from Iran runs onto the stage, he is only going to be a disruptive element. And so from a Japanese point of view, I can entirely understand why they are so unsettled by people like me. And the only way that we can be placed inside the society is as sort of token sources of tragicomedy and figures of fun.
Perhaps you would still be here simply having come here and found all of its sublime peace that it gives you and the ability to work and the pleasant outsider feeling it gives you. You also met and fell in love with a Japanese person whom you've written about.
And who, in the archetypal way of things, only dreams of California. But you're absolutely right. When I, my third week in Japan, 21 years ago, I met the woman who's now my wife. And what struck me then, and I think it's still the case, is that Japan is really doing the splits. Because what all of us notice, wherever we are, is that Japanese women are the ones traveling abroad, learning English, acquiring foreign partners, joining foreign companies, and staking out futures and destinies and possibilities in a foreign context that they could never have in rather stuck, fixed, traditional Japan. Whereas Japanese men, because the system favors them, are very much rooted in the way things have always been.
So here you were, newly in Japan. How did you meet?
Well, auspiciously enough, at a temple, at an initiation ceremony where a roshi, a high abbot of a Zen temple, a high master, was moving to some even higher degree of enlightenment or elevation or whatever. And so we just happened to be sitting next to one another at lunch. And I suppose what each of us quickly sensed, I quickly realized that she was just crying to break out of the role into which she'd been imprisoned, really, for all her 30 years. At that point, she'd never been on a plane. She'd never really been outside her hometown of Kyoto. And she had this vast hunger. So, of course, we were each reaching past one another because I was desperate to question her on 8th century Japanese poems and the like. But what's really startled me was that in the course of my year, which had meant to be 1 year of sitting stilly in a Zen temple, that actually became the year of watching her transform her life as quickly and dramatically and efficiently as Japan itself had transformed its life in the wake of the war. Almost the day Japan lost to America, it said, well, we're going to embrace the American system and do it better than America. And within a year, as if they just flipped the switch, they were doing it. So with Hiroko, having within the course of that year finished her qualifications to become a tour guide and starting to lead even more bewildered Japanese around the rest of the world.
So when you met 20 years ago, you spoke the same primitive Japanese that you speak today. She spoke very little English as well. We've established that your Japanese hasn't improved much. How about her English?
I wouldn't say it's improved at all either, but we're each so bad at the other's language, we haven't been able to instruct the other. So we still speak in sort of 4-year-old pidgin English, 21 years on. And I must say, I find I can communicate much better with her than with many of my friends back in California, where I'm babbling and babbling like this, but probably, you know, off on my own planet, just thinking about how to make a nice sentence or how to say something cool that will stay with them, and not actually thinking about communication. Whereas with her, I have to use words that she'll understand, and I'm really anxious to get the meaning across, like a present I would be handing from myself over to her, and she conversely. And in some ways, which I suppose she's been instructing me in, is how to speak without language as I know it. And how to navigate or negotiate almost any situation without needing to use excess words. And it struck me at some point that I don't need four-syllable words or technical terms from the study of English literature to work out the destiny of my stepchildren or my step-parents. And so it's actually been very liberating for me to come to Japan, and especially through this unusual relationship, to see how much I can dispense with. And I've learnt Japanese well enough in that sense to say you talk only to offer something to somebody else, not to display yourself.
And I would think with a wife it would just reduce whole vast realms of possibility of bickering. Bickering is impossible if you really don't speak the language, right?
Beautifully said. I can't wound her with words. And I think this permeates everything in Japan's relations with the world as well as with one another. People learn always to avoid confrontation, and by not saying anything, to step past what in our context or society might quickly become a head-on collision. And again, it's been an instruction to me in the art of human relations, which I think Japan has mastered.
This is a pleasure, Pico. Thank you very much for coming out here and explaining Japan to us.
Thanks. This is really fun for me. This is the social highlight of my fall, so thank you.
You can see a video of Pico and me at that beautiful park in Nara at studio360.org.